Quaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 183. Again, with me today is Bill Buppert, and this is actually being recorded consecutive to the last podcast with Bill Buppert. So technically, it's still Tuesday, August 7th, but you'll probably be hearing this on Wednesday, August 8th, 2012. Bill, thank you very much for coming back on the show with me, or continuing on the show with me.
My pleasure.
I want to pick back up on something we were talking. And if listeners, if you haven't heard yesterday's podcast, literally shut this off and go back and download yesterday's podcast before you listen to this one. It'll make more sense. We're going to try to make this a freestanding podcast so you can hear it and understand it. But I think to get the full impact, you need to hear that podcast yesterday. But anyway, Bill, we were talking on the previous segment about the death penalty, and I had mentioned that I completely switched 180 degrees on my position. And I used to be, you know, here's the knee-jerk reaction. Somebody kills a little child or something. You want to kill him. And if you can't kill him, you want the state to kill him. And that seems like justice on the surface. And I'm even, you mentioned last time, you mentioned vengeance. And in a very, I can't just spit this out because it sounds like I'm crazy, but I can make an argument that vengeance is a good thing, like almost everything else, when it's kept in balance. But the problem with the state inflicting vengeance is that nobody, the state's not a person, and nobody sinned against the state. Nobody harmed the state. Nobody killed a piece of the state. So the only person who, in my mind, the only person who has a right to vengeance is either the actual victim or the immediate heirs and family of the victim.
You know, I agree with that, Ben, and I want to make one qualifier, if I may. I am opposed to state-initiated death penalty. I am not opposed to the death penalty imposed on somebody who violates my zero aggression principle, and I'm going to defend myself in a fashion that may make the perpetrator assume room temperature. When I went to Bad Quaker to get acquainted with the site, And I think I had mentioned to you, I just love the fact that you refer to yourself as a bad Quaker. It's just one of those things where people say, what does that mean? It forces people to figure out what's a bad Quaker. So I go on your site to discover what a bad Quaker is. And you're right, because the difference between myself and a pacifist is that I think that pacifism is a road to extinction. I am very robust in my self-defense. I take pride in my ability to defend myself, whether open hand, with firearms, whatever the case may be, and try to keep my professional edge. But as far as the death penalty imposed by the state, I agree completely because, you know, we live in a country today that has codified torture, that has codified the unwarranted, in both variations of that word, unwarranted, the unwarranted killing by the president. The president apparently has a kill list that he reviews on a daily or weekly basis where he determines the fate of people around the globe and probably within our own borders. And we see how cops behave, and we see the kind of privations of life and liberty that are visited on everybody every day and you know, from burg to city to town to village. Across the fruited plains here in America, the death penalty is imposed on hundreds of people a year. So I think once the government is given that ability, they will not stop.
What you mentioned there, too, I think needs to be underscored because, you know, it's almost we almost talk past it very often nowadays that the president has the ability to just point at a name and a person dies. That this has never happened before in the United States history, but we did see this with dictators and emperors in days gone by. But that's a scary thought. Even if you're pro death penalty, that's got to shock you a little bit. On the other hand, if you are pro death penalty, why does that shock you?
I agree completely. I mean, it's interesting how it coarsens people. It's also why I happen to be against abortion, is because I think that when you take the most innocent of life, the unborn, and you allow them to be given the ultimate sanction of being murdered in the womb, it coarsens us. Torture of individuals coarsens us, as we discovered with the French in Algeria, and I would submit in Indochina in the 1950s. They used torture to a large extent, codified it, institutionalized it. And not only does it have an effect, obviously, on the people who are tortured, it has an effect on the mindset of those who kill and torture, and they will bring that home. What you'll notice today, for instance, with the British Empire, what was the British Empire, is that the United Kingdom has 25% of all the CCTVs on Earth. It is a surveillance society. London has really metastasized the for everybody to see just how militaristic and tightly controlled a nation state it is. Anything that a government practices abroad, it will eventually come home. In the American Empire, we've practiced rendition. We practiced black prisons. We practiced Guantanamo. We practiced torture. As you mentioned, the president now has a kill list in which he doesn't really need anything. He doesn't even need a judicial finding. He simply needs an intelligence finding to kill somebody. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of I'm really intrigued by the ancient world, the Romans and the Greeks, and I've done a lot of study in the past year of the Romans. What you discover is that the Roman emperors, after the Republic fell, had this ultimate sanction. Almost without exception, these Roman emperors were cold-blooded killers. And by the way, they also became incredibly distorted, twisted, and kinked up individuals too, because they were given this unlimited power. And that unlimited power tended to corrupt them in a fashion that would even make somebody, even make the Marquis de Sade blanch. Mm-hmm. But I also think that Acton's axiom about power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, that Buperts' corollary to that axiom is that power attracts the corruptible, and that absolute power attracts even worse. And that's what we see here. We see in this lovely constitutional republic we live in, we see powers invested in the president that we criticize the National Socialists and the Soviets for exercising themselves.
Mm-hmm. I just shake my head, in amazement as you're saying those things. It's almost like this stuff can't be true, but yet it absolutely is the situation we live in.
History is always more interesting than fiction. That's what I've discovered. And Gore Vidal recently passed. I think it was July 31st. Right. He was a man of letters, probably one of the best men of letters this country ever produced, if not the Western world. His fictional narratives of America, starting with Burr, going through Lincoln and his Empire series, in fiction, he really laid out what America's history truly is, more so than everything you can read from the American Historical Association or the Association of American Historians and Eric Foner and his Marxoid phoniness and such. You can read all the academic journals you want. You can read all of that stuff. But what you find in American history is that those of you who attend government schools, which is 99% of us, you were lied to about American history most of the time because it's all a tissue of lies.
Yeah, absolutely. In our last podcast that we did, we were talking about Washington and the myths and lies surrounding him.
Yeah,
and you brought up the Whiskey Rebellion.
Yeah,
and are you familiar? I didn't ask you ahead of time. I apologize for this, but are you familiar with St. Clair's defeat, or it's also called? I think it was the Second Battle of the Wabash, if I recall.
I am not, but I'd love to be.
It was the single worst defeat the U.S. Army has ever, even to date, has ever suffered. And I think it was something like, two-thirds of the entire army at the time was wiped out in a single battle in a single day.
What year was that?
1792, I believe. Let me look real quick here.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
1791, I think, was the first battle. St. Clair's defeat. Ooh, but I might have to take little clips of
now,
this
when
out.
Now, when you talk
so
about St. Clair, though, you're not talking about the St. Clair who was ambushed in the French and Indian Wars before 1765, are you?
No, this was after Washington was elected.
Because your audience will recall if they watched a movie called Last of the Mohicans, there was a British column that was torn apart by the Aboriginals that was portrayed in the film, and that was based on a debacle with either a St. Clair or a Clare. So that was based on actual fact. What happened?
In the situation with St. Clair's defeat, or I think it was, if I recall, the Second Battle of Wabash, Washington had intentionally ordered two fairly incompetent commanders to march out of what was then Fort Washington or Cincinnati and go into an area that was heavily controlled by the natives at that time. And it was pretty much an intentional a death sentence for those guys. And then in order to make up for what the blunder that he had just done, and it may not have been a blunder, I would contend that it wasn't a blunder, but he sent St. Clair with a larger, stronger force, but it was still really weak compared to Little Turtle and Blue Jacket that he was marching into. And those guys just shredded St. Clair and his forces. And then Washington goes to the newfound Congress and says, look, we have this horrible problem in the Northwest, and I need a military. We don't have a strong enough military. And so all kinds of new laws were passed, and a new military was basically born that the government did not have prior to that time. And then what does he do with it? Does he march off and take on Blue Jacket? No. No, he goes and marches into northern Pennsylvania and starts shooting citizens.
You know, it's so interesting. I had tangentially heard of it, but never looked into it. But I'm gonna examine that. I'm always fascinated by new facets of military history that I'm not familiar with.
I can't help but to suspect, and I've said this, you know, openly, I can't help but to suspect he did that on purpose because he could not take on the tax rebels for the whiskey tax. He couldn't take on the tax rebels with the military that he had. He had to do something to get Congress to give him a military. And St. Clair's defeat was either a really odd convenience or it was contrived.
How interesting. Yeah, I'll have to examine that. That's fascinating.
And of course, Washington was the largest whiskey producer at the time. I should always throw that in.
You know, would I put it past Washington to do just what you said as far as political intrigue? Not at all. And would I put it past him to sacrifice what were then Americans instead of British soldiers to do so? There's no doubt.
I wanted to ask you to comment on the parallel development of the USA and the USSR during the 20th century.
What an interesting question. I did a talk in 2010 at the Freedom Summit in which I talked about the coming de-Sovietization of the United States. And of course, implicit in that title is that I would think that the United States was Sovietized to a certain extent. And I stand by that. In 1917 and 1918, when the Russians had their revolution, the Tsar was deposed and they imposed their Soviet Republic. If you look at a lot of the facets of the Soviet Republic, and then you look at the parallel development of the United States at the time, you discover that there are some uncomfortable parallels. But you also discover that after Coolidge and Harding, who are two of my favorite presidents along with Grover Cleveland, and when I say favorite, they're not people I would invite over for dinner because I think that most of them were pretty awful people. Because in this pantheon of American presidents, it just goes from bad to worse in so many fashions. But after Coolidge and you have Hoover, what you discover is what one writer would call a managerial state, what others would call a fascist state, what others would call a state that's trying to fashion itself not along communist lines, but fashion itself in a way in which the part of the GDP that the government owns would increase over time. This metastasized, of course, with who I'm fond of calling Red DR, which is FDR. And during the four Roosevelt administrations, you saw this almost hyperspeed increase in the size of government. It's interesting, too, when you read Amity Schley's book on the Forgotten Man, she talks that between 1933, to be fair to Roosevelt, 1933 and 1938, despite all of these programs that the government put in place for employment, the unemployment level still increased by 1.5 percentage points. Then, of course, FDR has to get into a war. I often refer to World War II as the war to save Joseph Stalin. And I know that sounds like some hyperbole, but when you think of it in the end, no one is saying that the National Socialists should have been saved, but everyone is saying that the Soviets should have been saved. To what end, I don't know. In my mind, we should have allowed – World War I was a mistake. World War II was a mistake as far as our involvement. And we could have stayed aside and not took sides in World War II and watched what happened. Possibly – and of course, this is counterfactual – maybe the National Socialists and the Soviets would have engaged in a ruinous conflict that destroyed both of them. And I think the world would be better off in that fashion. But at the time, and you look at the Venona transcripts and such, and they prove this out, the FDR administration was so rife and riven, along with the British, with Soviet agents. As a matter of fact, there's I think it was either Harry Dexter White or Harry Hopkins in the Department of Agriculture and a chief of staff for Roosevelt. Both of these guys were active Soviet agents at the time with active Soviet. And I wrote about this on my blog. If you look through there, you can find this somewhere. I can't quite pinpoint it right now. But they even had Soviet code names, uranium shipments, the amount of money that was spent. And you have FDR saying, well, should we adopt the Soviet model? Because I really think he was itching to do so. But he knew that his electoral success would be dwindled if he were to do that. There's one point in 1943 where we have the income tax withholding given to us by Milton Friedman. In 1916, the income tax was set at approximately 2 to 5 percentage points above $100,000 or whatever the wealth was at the time that you needed, and everything else was exempted. By 1943, a mere two generations later, we have FDR seriously considering with his economic advisors imposing a 100% tax on all incomes above $100,000. Now, even his collectivist sycophants and counselors said, that's taking it a bit too far if we go to 100%. They settle on 94%. The reason I'm going into this slight segue is to show that what they came up with is they said the communist model – even back then, simply doesn't work, despite the fact that Stalin was Time's man of the year twice between 1933 and 1945. Mussolini was Time's man of the year. It was a time in which fascism, communism, collectivism was at its high point, where people were saying, this is the future of humanity. This is how to assure that we will live on the fruited plain and that there will be this aggregate and potpourri of treasure for everybody as a result of central planning. Even FDR had that conceit, but even they knew that what we need to do is convince the Americans themselves that they have freedom and liberty. We need to give them that illusion so they'll keep working. I know that sounds a bit trite, but they wanted to make it because, an axiom in the Soviet Union for the longest time was, we'll pretend to work while you pretend to pay us.
Yeah.
So what FDR wanted to do and his counselors was find a way to grab as much of the GDP pie as they could through government appropriation taxes and regulation, but do it in a fashion in which the cattle living within that tax jurisdiction thought that they retained the freedom and liberty to earn what they wished. We know otherwise. So I do see a parallel development where we took on a kinder and gentler Soviet model instead of the more rash Soviet model that the USSR took on. But I will give you some statistics that are pretty alarming. In 1953, under Joseph Stalin and the peak population of the Gulag, our present in the last year, 2011, our present probationers, parolees, and caged inmates from the local to the federal level are almost four times the peak level of both the criminal and political population of the Gulag in 1953.
Wow.
we do have the highest per capita imprisonment rate on the globe in America, in the land of the free and the home of the brave. And I would submit to you that I'm included. I think every family in America is touched by somebody who's been entangled in the legal system. Sure. And has had a family member fined, caged, maimed, or killed by our legal system.
Let me interrupt you there and save this file so that we have it, and then I'll come right back, and I want to jump right back into that topic.
Okay.
Folks, I hope you're enjoying the interview with Bill Buport, and I was so glad to have him with me on the podcast. And again, just a reminder, Bill's website is zerogov.com, and his book is ZeroGov. And I also want to tell you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you're going to find video files, audio files, and you can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. Now, who's this for? It's for anybody who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and for unschoolers. But it's also good for anybody who wants to learn about liberty while avoiding state propaganda. Take this course, and Tom Woods and his team will equip you with one of the very best tools the liberty movement has to offer: knowledge. Real knowledge in a usable form. Now, who else are you going to find at Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom? Kevin Gutzman, the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, which is on my list of Ben's suggested books to own. Plus, lots of other noted educators and students will help guide you to your understanding of history and Austrian economics. So what's this kind of an education worth to you and your family? Well, at Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all of this for about $8 a month. This gets you access to everything on the site, all the courses plus additional courses that will be added in the future, the discussion forums, the optional live sessions, and reading suggestions. So how do you do this? Go to badquaker.com. Click on the banner on the right-hand column where you see the ad for Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll keep badquaker.com on the internet a little longer. Thanks very much, folks, and be sure and click on that link from badquaker.com and go to Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. Thanks. Okay, and we're back again, and I want to pick right back up on what we were talking about there. You know, you and I talked last night on the phone, and I mentioned that I wanted to bring this up to you. The inner cities in America and the small towns out in the Midwest and places like that, I'm wondering, I don't know, you know, I hate to bring any kind of conspiracy theory into play when I realize that much of what government does, no matter how evil it is, it's just out of the natural processes that are already in place, not necessarily a conspiracy. It's just a natural outcrop.
And incompetence.
And, yeah, and vast levels of incompetence.
Oceans.
Yeah, but it almost appears as though there's a plan to disarm large segments of the American population using felony convictions, because the guy's name escapes me, but there's a really good book called Three Felonies a Day.
I just picked that up, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. And I think he lays out a really good argument that almost anybody that the government actually wants to pick up and convict, they can do it. Because the laws are so vague and so many that it's almost impossible to go through your daily life without committing a felony.
Amen. And the prosecutorial neglect and overzealousness in this country is, to me, it rivals the Soviet court system in its heyday. I don't know whether I have the, because it was 2 years ago when I gave this talk, Ben, I don't know whether these numbers still stand or not. For prosecutorial misconduct in this country, there were 235 formal investigations of prosecutors. Guess how many prosecutors were censured, fined, or even imprisoned because of what they did to people?
I'm sure it's a small amount.
Three.
Wow.
Three. And the prosecutors, not only does it riff off of what you just said, where they can find any law they wish and stretch it like like what's happening to raw milk advocates in LA and such.
Mm-hmm.
What you discover is that they have an unlimited pocketbook. I mean, what's going to happen if you and I get picked up, for instance, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to say, you better cop a plea. Well, why do you have to cop a plea? Because they don't want you to go to jury because jury's expensive. They also don't want you to go to jury because, especially if you go to jury in New Hampshire now with the jury nullification powers that they have, you may end up getting off and the prosecutor won't get a notch in his belt. So they have the overwhelming advantage in the system.
But they will use strong arm tactics to convince you that you have to take a plea, even to the point of where, and I know this first, not from me personally, but I know this firsthand with people that I've talked to, they'll offer them things that are not even close to what they were accused of as bait to get them to accept it, to prevent something like, well, you know, if you don't, we're going to have you on a sexual predator list or something like this. And so they, rather than fight a ridiculous charge that they might or might not be able to beat, they'll accept a charge that has nothing to do with the original accusation.
Which is why they'll pile so many charges on.
So yeah, that exactly.
Yeah, because they pile them on, and those charges almost, they don't act in parallel. They act in aggregate so that in the end, if 15 charges add up to 150 years, we'll take this charge off and it'll make it 140.
Yeah.
So it's absurd. It's very Kafkaesque too, from what I hear from folks who are entangled in it. Number one rule, don't talk to the cops.
Right. I want to also ask about your opinion of, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the Bonus Army back in the late 20s and early 30s. And I wanted to draw a comparison between the current Occupy movement and the Bonus Army back then. I know you don't have a very high opinion of the Occupy movement, and I've put some effort into mocking them as well.
That is an understatement as far as the Occupy movement. I had hopes, but then again, I had these same hopes where, while I'm a non-voter, I did have hopes when Barack Obama was stumping. I said, well, he may be a socialist at home, but maybe he is a true peace candidate. But you and I have seen the results of that. I held out hope that he would be anti-war, but then again, collectivists can't be anti-war, because if they're anti-war, that really takes their power from them.
Yeah, it's the true thing there that I can't remember who said it now, that the war is the health of the state.
Randolph Bourne.
That's right. That's right. But that really is true. It just feeds off of it.
Well, it needs it. I mean, you'll find in the 20th century, when you look at World War I, World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War, and all the other wars that we've been involved in, every time those occur, the state is able to expand. I mentioned earlier in 1943, when Milton Friedman gives us the withholding tax, that happened under wartime. When we saw our tax rates expand to 94%, it happened under wartime. When you look at Woodrow Wilson's league that he employed to go after anarchist tax resistors, peace marchers, suffragettes and such during World War I, he literally got a band of thugs deputized in the tens of thousands who went around and broke heads, giving people wood shampoos or finding them, caging them, whatever the case may be. Why did he do that? Well, it was World War I. Did Wilson come in saying, we will not get involved in a European war? He did. What did he do 3 days after getting into office? He started intriguing so that he could get us involved in the conflict.
And the Bonus Army was a result of that. It was veterans from the First World War who had been promised a series of bonuses and retirement money, if I recall.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when the economy took a dip, they were in really bad shape, and it looked like they needed to take drastic action. I'll let you take the story from there.
Well, Coolidge vetoed the bill, essentially, to granting bonuses to veterans of World War I. But Congress overrode that veto a few days later, and that was in 1924. By 1932, of course, the Depression had been in full swing for almost 2 years, and they finally marched on Washington and started to make their demands heard that we want to have these veterans benefits given to us that the government guaranteed us. MacArthur, Patton, Eisenhower, not general officers, but captains and majors respectively at the time, rode in along with the Federal Army at the time and burned tents, beat down marchers, and basically abused these people for trying to make the government do right with the promises it had made nearly a generation before. And I see no comparison whatsoever with Occupy Wall Street. I think Occupy Wall Street, I remember you and I spoke about this on the phone. I remember talking to some OWS folks in a city that I was visiting, and I was talking to them. I was just appalled at how anti-liberty and pro-collectivist they were. They might as well have been waving red flags. And it was from the banal of, I want somebody to take my $250,000 student debt bill for medieval literature appreciation and pay it for me because I made a bad call and I had bad judgment in how I spent my money and I want you to bail me out, all the way to the other side where they're saying, well, you know, while Obama's not anti-war right now, it's a righteous war that we're fighting over there. And you'd hear them sort of almost rationalizing why we're at war around the globe and why it's not the wrong thing. And, you know, almost as if they were there as Obama players. But in the end, what OWS wants is those very cops that they're very polite to and very kind to and they coordinate with. The cops that established the cordons around OWS and such, except for some of the times when the cops actually gave them wood shampoos, those cops, for the most part, represent the where the rubber meets the road on the world vision that the OWS folks have, because the OWS folks are statist and collectivist first and foremost, and you can't be a statist or a collectivist without having a love affair with the police state, because absent a police state, no one's going to cooperate because no one wants to work in that fashion. You know, I remember talking to one of them and saying, what you're telling me is that I think that we pay nearly two-thirds of our income in taxes today. When you add everything up, Ben, when you look at the federal income tax, the state income tax, the our mortgage taxes, our property taxes, our excise taxes, our gas taxes, we all pay corporate income taxes. If the corporate income tax is 35%, that's passed on as an increased price in the good and service, and you and I pay that. The corporations don't. You know, it's simple economics. So that's why I say that it's nearly that much. So what you're saying to me is that as an OWS person, you want to increase taxes, but in essence, Bill can go into Ben's house every month and I can take two-thirds of his stuff at gunpoint, and not only am I justified in doing that, but it's patriotic. That's wacky.
Yeah. I would think if I had to draw a comparison between the Bonus Army and the Occupy movement, I would think they're both the common ground would be that they both naively believe that their actions are going to produce something good for them. But in the end, in either case, it happened with the Bonus Army, but I think it could happen with the Occupy movement. If they ever really become a serious threat, the state will just go in there and use those same police and beat them, shoot them, kill them, whatever has to be done. March the military on them if necessary, and they will be demonized just like the Bonus Army was demonized, and an excuse will be made, and then it'll all be swept aside and everybody will forget about them.
I agree 100%, and they won't have to bring in the military because the cops will do what they're told no matter how outrageous and unvirtuous and immoral it is. The cops will do what they're told.
What real difference is there today? And I don't. This is maybe rhetorical in a sense, but it's not also. But what real difference is there today in the police that we have in the United States and a basic domestic army meant to hold the citizens captive?
That's a rhetorical question. It needs no further amplification. You've elegantly said what you needed to.
Well, let me take this in a different direction then. I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm almost saying something that I almost never say out loud, and certainly I've never said to the microphone before, but I think the U.S. military around, I'm going to say around 2010 or maybe early 2011, came real close to, I don't want to say a revolution, but there was a tipping point there where they almost said no to Washington, D.C., and then some shifts were made, and I think am I way off on my estimation?
I don't know about that. I can't speak to that definitively in any fashion because I don't know anything about it, but I do know that in the ramping up to the Iraq War, there was a lot of alarm among junior and mid-level officers who were looking at all the casus belli, the 22, the casus belli, to include WMDs that Bush came up with for the invasion of Iraq, and saying none of this adds up, especially in the intelligence community. A lot of them were saying this simply doesn't add up. There's nothing here that justifies our invasion of Iraq. But the general officers, those who are 07 and above in the DOD and the Army community, they're going to do what they're told because they're political apparatchiks. They're not military folks so much as folks who are invested in a system that treats them and remunerates them very well. And very few general officers will resign over points of conscience or morality or differences in opinion with the way things have to go. There's a and I think one thing that leads to this is that we have this notion in the American military that you can't be politically involved domestically. It's against the Uniform Code of Military Justice for me to show up in uniform and advocate for a political candidate or to speak on political issues on television or in public functions, things like that. I can't do that.
Right. Right.
The mistake we've made, though, is that the Army thinks that it could be completely divorced from politics. It says we're above that. They like to say they're above that, but what they are is they're ignorant of it. Now, that's been a two-edged sword because in the prosecution of irregular warfare conflicts, which is essentially what we've been involved in since the end of World War II, politics is the lion's share of what you must pay attention to, recognize, manipulate, and use to win the conflicts we've been involved in. If you don't pay attention to that and you only pay attention to military factors, you will lose. And of course, our track record has demonstrated that we don't pay attention to politics. So I think to a certain extent, on the one hand, military officers will say, we can't get involved in domestic politics, so we're not going to concern ourselves with it. And by extension, we're going to be relegated to consistent failure in our prosecution of conflicts overseas since the end of World War II because we're not paying attention to politics. I think, to a large extent, there needs to be more military officers who simply stand up and say, I'm not going to fly a UAV that's going to kill a person unless you've given me a judicial finding on why I'm killing this person. Or, for instance, with the collateral damage that occurs and things like that. There's a project I'd like to talk to you about offline that I can't talk about right now, but in the next 6 months, I'm working on something with a colleague of mine about this very thing that could – I'm not calling it a game changer, but it's certainly a way to disincentivize politicians getting involved in these foreign conflicts because their own lives will be on the line as a result.
From a purely economic point of view, and I think you've said things similar to this before – the U.S. government itself, its spending habits, its embracing of the policies that it has, you know, in every direction, it's pretty much self-destructive. That's almost guaranteed. And I'm looking for an economic collapse of pretty serious proportions in the very near future. I'm not saying 6 months or something, but I'm saying, you know, it's definitely coming at us. What are your thoughts on that area?
Oh, I think the economic collapse is inevitable. And I've talked about this on other programs and in my writings. And you know, what's happened with the pigs, with Portugal, Ireland, Greece, Spain, and such. California is in the very same shape as Greece, but California has a sugar daddy in the U.S. government. It's a matter of funding Socialist Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the new Obama health care plan, veterans benefits, veterans pensions, and pensions, for instance, if Bill and Ben are police officers who have served 20 years in California, and we can retire at, let's say, 80 to 100% of our pensions for the rest of our lives, it is absolutely unsustainable with this demographic tidal wave that we have in front of us. So to me, this economic collapse that is bandied about, it certainly isn't a matter of if, but when.
You know, sometimes there's this effect of the boy who cried wolf. And I heard this said after the 2000 bubble, after, you know, there was a lot of buildup in anticipation of something happening in 2000, and it didn't happen the way a lot of people thought it might. And now, for the last few years, we've been in a similar situation where a lot of people believe that there's an economic crash coming. And other people are saying, yeah, but you said that in 2000. But I think what we're looking at now is very different from the, although it's a continuation, it's very different from 2000. And I think it's really far more serious even than what most people were talking about in 2000.
Look, the further they kick this can down the road, the worse it's going to be. And there is nothing in history since Rome's 2,214-year run as an empire. There is nothing in history where a global reserve currency like ours all of a sudden becomes worthless and the impact that has rippling around the planet. This will inaugurate a new Stone Age of sorts when this collapse happens, because no one's planning properly for it at the government level. But of course, they can't, because you and I both know central planning has not, will not, and will not possibly work, and that it will always make things worse.
That's absolutely true. Let me pause us here and save this file again.
Okay.
Folks, have you seen the silver and gold trading cards from Shire Silver? You have to check these out. They're specific weights of real silver or gold laminated inside trading cards, and they're a great way to show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. And now you can buy them using bitcoins or Federal Reserve notes. Folks, you really need to check this out. Go over to Shire Silver, watch the video on the main page, check out the list of merchants that accept silver and gold trading cards, and you can even learn how you can get paid to help spread the word about Shire Silver trading cards. Hi, this is Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker from BadQuaker.com. I listen to the Freedom Fiends live Sunday night on the Liberty Radio Network. That's LRN.FM. And you can hear the Freedom Fiends 24/7 on their streaming feed at FreedomFiends.com. That's FreedomFiends.com. Okay, and we're back again with Bill Buepert. And I want to mention his website, that's zerogov.com, and his book, ZeroGov, and you can get that on Amazon. You can get it. You can find the links at badquaker.com. You can go over to zerogov.com and find the links there. But either way, again, you know, I said this in the last interview, the book is $3.99. I mean, it's the price of a hamburger. You just got to grab it, and, you know, okay, anyway.
Just make sure that you eat the hamburger without the bun. That's all I ask.
Yeah.
Don't eat wheat or gluten. Wheat or gluten is the enemy.
I'm anti-grain as well.
Excellent.
I've talked, although I, you know, I'm not a purist. I sin quite often, but but I talk quite a bit about the fact that the birth of the overproduction of grain coincided with the birth of the state, because there's several things in there. I won't take us off in that whole direction. My audience hears me talk about this all the time, but there's several things in there with the great man theory, and we had to have this hero god to found our government upon, and there was the overproduction of grain, which made mass production of slaves possible, because now you can feed the slaves. And all these things came together all at once, and because of those things, we have a state. But if you can remove any one of those things, the whole house of cards falls apart. If you realize that the state is not made up of great men that save us from evil destinies, or if you take away the overproduction of grain and all of a sudden the slaves can't eat and they have to do something to support themselves, or any of these other chunks, the whole state, the whole myth of the state falls apart, and people are left not in a utopia. I think you call it a dystopia.
I do call it a dystopia.
Because, and the way, you
know,
I say it,
you can't advance unless you fail.
Yeah, the way I say it, you know, the sweetness of honey has to have the sting of the bee. You have to have. There's.
I like that. That's a good turn of phrase.
I also quote another person that says, "He who made kittens put snakes in the grass," and that, you know, that's nature. That's what we were meant to be. That's how we got to where we are. Not by having some giant socialistic monster absorb the blows for us so that we can live our lives without repercussions.
I agree completely. And you know, it's the insulation from failure and foibles that is the siren song that keeps so many people at the government teat, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whether it's student loans, which which of course is part and parcel of the OWS movement, or the subsidy of the Big Seven as far as the grain subsidies, corn, and you know, we have thousands of crops that we could grow, different distinct crops, and of course we make 7 to 12 primarily. And there's a war being waged against those who wish to grow their own. You know, we have our own garden, we have our own cattle, that kind of stuff. But like you were saying earlier, with 3 felonies a day, if they wanted to, all of us who are gentleman farmers, they could come in and find some statute or regulation or law that we've broken as a result of trying to establish our own self-sufficiency food-wise.
I think it's probably a good idea for us to talk about self-sufficiency a little bit.
Sure.
There's some economic type people in our movement that want to talk about division of labor, and that's really important. Division of labor is not, you know, I've heard people say, well, no man's an island, and it doesn't do any good to learn all these specialized skills because of the division of labor. But really, I think that's a misunderstanding of the whole concept. Without a community of all of us together, how am I saying that? I'll tell you what, I remember one time you were talking about how you're good with guns, but you're not good at, you know, like gunsmithing. So you work on the thing that's strong for you, but you also depend on the community for the things where you can't quite fill in the gaps.
Amen. But, you know, Claire Wolf wrote an article in Backwoods Home magazine where she talked about files in the Greek spelling phyles, let's suppose that I am especially good at manipulation of guns, but not gunsmithing. And I share stuff with people, and I take time out with my community or my network of friends or the village that I live in. And I do that, and I trade or barter my time, not keeping a ledger, but somebody knows how to grow tomatoes much better than I do, so they come and give me a one-hour tutorial. I know how to grow cows better than they do. I go over and I tell them how to grow grass. I don't know gunsmithing, but I go and I get a basic preventative maintenance course on a new weapon system that I'm adopting from somebody who's very familiar with that. Not only that, food, for instance. Food, I've gone through some severe dietary changes in the last few years. I'm now a paleo Taubian eater, and I try to avoid sugars, carbs, wheat, gluten, that kind of thing. And I've seen huge health benefits. So people will say, well, so what can I do for that? Well, I'll send them links, or I'll talk to them. You know, we all have our own specialized knowledge that we can share with people in a voluntary and cooperative fashion. And in the end, the sum truly is greater than its parts as a result of that kind of free voluntary association and sharing of ideas and information and knowledge.
So we can have both self-sufficiency and the division of labor by creating a community among us and by sharing information, but and also developing networks that are not necessarily dependent upon the existing systems.
I think the Amish and the Mennonites, for those who may be put off by their religionist sentiments, nonetheless, if we were to divorce that, even though we can't entirely, because that's part of the cultural imperative for them that makes them so successful, they are markers for how self-sufficiency can work in a community of voluntary labor.
Mm-hmm. And in many ways, they're very anarchical. Anyway, although they do have a superstructure within their, you know, within their religious framework, they have leadership and everything like that. But it's all 100% voluntary.
Well, you know, it's what I mentioned, Ben, about I want a world without rulers, but not a world without rules, because there's no such thing. We all have that. If you and I, for instance, were tippling the Scottish holy water on your porch, I wouldn't toss it in your face, and I wouldn't toss it in your face because you're a bad host or I'm a bad guest. I do that because I have my own moral compass and my own worldview that tells me how best to get along with people around. I don't do it because I'm afraid of a jail sentence. I practice good manners because that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, and there's if we can take the words of two different philosophers from two different if you understand what Mises was talking about in praxeology, and you also think about what Stefan Molyneux has talked about with universally preferred behavior, people tend to do what is best for them. And if you take a person and shove them into a governmental situation with a lot of power, they tend to do what's best for them. But if you have people functioning with their neighbors and functioning with other people in society, when they do what's best for them, it also works the best for the community.
I agree. I maintain my own private road to get to the highway. But to show you just how corrosive and nasty the slightest stain of government involvement can be, talk to anybody you know who doesn't like their homeowners association, and you can see that the banality of evil will take place under government auspices at the lowest level possible, which to me is an HOA. I mean, government does monstrous things, but the HOA, the homeowners association, proves to me that it will attract the worst people to get on the board, and it will attract the worst behavior, and the incentives are perverse across the board.
Let's take this back to the subtitle of your book, because what you're talking about there with the homeowners association is kind of like the smallest, the minimalist government that a person could think of, and yet it's hideous.
Well, this whole notion of limited government is false. It's a false dichotomy. It has no historical precedent, antecedent. There, no one can show me in history, East or West, a government either rising from the ashes or rising out of whole cloth that within a very short time span doesn't expand beyond its original charter. It doesn't happen. You know, we hear the conservatives talking and the neoconservatives talking about limited government. There's no such thing. There never has been any such thing. And I suppose, and this may sound bold, I don't think limited government is possible because of the actors that it attracts that get the levers of power. Their natural inclination is not to limit that power, but to expand that power. And we could just look at American history to prove that that's the case.
Right. In our last few minutes here, I want to do two things. I want you to tell us about the Appleseed Project and what you do with it. And I want you to also, again, we did this in the last podcast, but I want you to tell us about your website and more about your book.
Okay, I'll do that. The Appleseed Project, I'm a shoot boss in the state of Arizona. I'm retiring from that position and going in on an active step. In September, it will be my last shoot. I've sponsored dozens of these shoots, and basically it's a marksmanship and history project that is sponsored by the Revolutionary War Veterans Association. And we have a two-day rifle clinic at which we try to give you the basics of rifle marksmanship out to a simulated 500 meters. And we talk about the events of April 19, 1775, more popularly known as Lexington and Concord, the shot heard around the world, to show the linkage between liberty and marksmanship. So in a nutshell, that's what Appleseed comes down to.
And your website is zerogov.org.
No, it's zerogov.com.
Oh, I'm sorry. It is. Yeah. I'm looking right at it and read it wrong.
As a matter of fact, there is a zerogov.org, I think, but it's a British organization that is not very zerogov.
Oh. Yeah. So don't go there.
It's zerogov.com. I don't publish pieces on my blog as often as I should, and I'm reminded of that by my wife on a frequent basis. But I did publish something recently on American Utes and youth and why they may not be the salvation that we may consider them to be. Mm. And I have a forum that you can find. There's a tab there on the zerogov.com blog, a forum. I wish more people would – I always invite more people to get involved in the forum, where we have some pretty substantive discussions on how we're going to get to this this stateless society, this abolitionist society that I envision. My book is called Zero Gov, Limited Government, Unicorns and Other Mythological Creatures. It's a compilation of my essays since 2003. It is $3.99 on Amazon. You can also borrow it. You can also read 25% of it for free, I think it is, with the program I'm currently in with Amazon. And a slight editorial note for all of you author aspirants out there. There's a revolution going on right now. This revolution is just as vital and just as earth-shattering as the Gutenberg was, because this revolution is such that we can go make an end run around the New York and LA publishing houses that have dominated the conversation about knowledge for the longest time, because now you can publish essentially without them. you can publish for less than $50. I mean, somebody can come out. There's a book out there that I just purchased the other day on Swiss style cantons and confederations. It's 60 pages, but it's a book on this man's notions of why democracies are bad, but why cantons and Swiss confederation style is a better way to go. And by the way, the Swiss canton system was an influence on the crafting of the Articles of Confederation in 1775 that was taken over by the coup in 1787 when they formed the Constitution. So, Ben, I know that there's probably several books inside you to be published, and you no longer need to get an agent. You no longer need to go to a New York publishing house. You no longer even need to publish it as a physical tome. You can publish it simply electronically, which is what I chose to do with ZeroGov. But I do urge everybody to get an editor. If you don't get an editor, you're going to be embarrassed.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show with me, Bill. And I want to urge everybody to get over to your website. And I'm not even going to try to butcher the name one more time.
ZeroGov.com.
And there'll be links on badquaker.com to it. So be sure and get over there and get involved in the website and get the book. Thank you very much. Folks, thank you very much for listening. For more on liberty, property rights, and the zero aggression principle, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much, folks.